Thank you, Maria Cristina, and thank you everybody for showing up today. You know, it's not a small thing to show up, is it? You know, it's just not a small thing to show up. I'll get to the other thing in a minute, but I've been reading Sharon Brous's new book called The Amen Effect. And Sharon Brous is the rabbi of the Los Angeles community, ICAR. And she talks a lot about you just show up and you go to the funeral, you go to the wedding, you go to the party, you go to the intimate gathering, because it can be easy sometimes not to show up. There are a lot of barriers sometimes to showing up. And so I just want to say how much I appreciate that you're here today. And that we get to see each other, hang out, talk about the Dharma, meditate together, and just do that. You know, there's no big agenda around it. It is simply just let's show up together. So, thank you. I am joining you from the ancestral land of the Wiat. I'm about 300 miles north of San Francisco in a little tiny town called McKinleyville, which is on the coast in the Redwoods, and the sun is out today. It's not 50 degrees and raining. And in this moment, I'm feeling very grateful for a little bit of that uplift. So I want to invite you right now to, if you don't have your video on, if you'd like to turn it on, let yourself be seen so we can all look at each other. Again, you know, nobody ever knows who's looking at whom when, but it's pretty sweet to see who's here. So just take a look at each other, however you're feeling today, across the whole spectrum of really delighted to maybe not, to maybe somewhere meh in the middle. However you are, letting yourself be seen is a gift to the rest of us, and then we can see you. And of course, those who can't turn their video on, we know you're there, and that's wonderful. So you're welcome to be here exactly as you are. Such a pleasure. So the way our morning will go is we'll have a meditation, a Dharma talk, plenty of time to talk with each other. Pretty straightforward, pretty straightforward. But what I'd like to do also before we start is if you would like to put in the chat two things. Where are you geographically? Where are you calling in from? And how do you locate the state of your heart this morning, today? What's here? And we'll just go ahead and stick it in the chat so everybody can see. And that way we can all check in with each other. In that way, if anybody would like to write that in. Lily, Portland, anticipating. Chapel Hill, ease and even joy. Yeah. LA, spacious, from Christy. Larkspur, joyful. Nancy. Colorado Mountains, happy. Pasadena, grieving. Seattle, brokenhearted. Ruby, nervousness. Carolyn, spaciousness. Who said grieving? Sophia. Yeah. Okay. Brokenhearted, Sophia. Stephanie, heartbroken. I can feel all that. Can you feel it as you read through here? Tender from Rachel. Content from Tom. Grateful, settling in. Moment by moment. Yeah. Isn't this how it is? This is all of it is here. And to take a moment to recognize that there is grief here. There is brokenheartedness here. To let yourself know that. If you are the one feeling that, I really appreciate that you shared that. And if you are here with a more uplifted heart, use the strength of that to make a little space, not only for yourself to know what it's like to feel uplifted, but also a little space for those who aren't in that space right now. So we hold each other exactly as we are. Thank you for doing that, everybody. Okay. So let's move into our meditation. We'll be here for about a half an hour. So I invite you to find a posture that works really well for you. I'll offer some light guidance. And whether your posture is sitting on the furniture, sitting on the floor, perhaps reclining, might be reclining on furniture, reclining on the floor, or even standing, let yourself be held a little bit. Right from the beginning, see if you can soften. Imagine, before you point your attention anywhere specifically, this sense of giving over the weight of your body to the furniture or the floor, knowing it's held by the earth. And if you like, imagine sending roots down into the earth, maybe from your bottom or your feet or your back. Imagining roots that grow wide and deep, that are flexible, providing strength and steadiness, sustenance. Grounded in this body, connected to this earth of which we are a part, undeniably connected to this earth. And continuing to sense into this body, noticing specifically now those touch points where the body is touching whatever it's touching. Perhaps your feet are on the floor and you notice that. If you're sitting, noticing the backs of the thighs and the sit bones with the natural pressure that they make onto the furniture. Maybe your back is touching, noticing that sense of touch. Noticing the hands and the arms. Maybe the hands are clasped or resting on the lap. Just notice, however they are. You might notice the insides of the upper arms as they gently touch the sides of the torso. If your eyes are closed, the touch of the eyelids. If your mouth is closed, the touch of the lips. Maybe even noticing how the tongue rests in the mouth. All these ways of becoming aware of the sense of touch can bring the mind right here. Grounded in this body, alive in this body. And then, of course, there are all the ways in which on the inside of the body is connected to itself, the organs, the muscles, tendons, ligaments, bones, tissues and fluids. This very alive, deeply connected body. Becoming aware of the breath coming and going. noticing the specificity of the inhale, the beginning, the middle, and end. Likewise, the exhale, the beginning, the middle, and the end. Letting yourself sense completely into this experience of breathing. You might notice where you feel your breath the most in your body, the natural motion the body makes in response to the inhale and the exhale. Just notice. And that might be inaccessible to you, and if it is, that's fine. Just know you're breathing. Aware of the body, aware of the breathing. Sounds will come and go. Thoughts will come and go. States of heart will come and go. Within all of this, this fathom-long body, as the Buddha said, within this fathom-long body, all of the teachings can be known. We incline with this heart, these beautiful phrases. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. To show up completely as best you can with a friendly heart. So finding that place now where you can rest your attention and hang out there. Coming back when the mind goes somewhere else. Wherever that is for you that makes the most sense. Resting, attending. The quality of wakefulness. And we'll sit quietly. If you're noticing anywhere in the body that may be a little constrained, any tension, see if you can send a little softening energy to that area. Softening any amount. Thank you. noticing any amount of stillness that is here. Letting that be in the forefront of your awareness. Noticing any change in the energies of the heart. And letting whatever is here be held in this spaciousness, this space of stillness. Energies of joy or sorrow and everything in between is held right here. Not only in our own stillness, but the stillness of each other. Letting it all belong, letting the stillness be a place of support. from wherever you are, coming back into the body. Once again, noticing the touch points, the movement of the breath, whatever the state of mind or heart, mind, heart together, whatever it is, being here. This is a poem called The Man Who Decided to See by Jack Riddle. And for the first time, he saw the boy whose bicycle sped by his porch, then the yellowing leaf on the back step. He saw a cloud bank in his rearview mirror and followed the winding glide of the crack in the sidewalk he took to the grocery, where he saw the woman in the bakery look down, then touch her eye. The way his wife's hair spread across her shoulders in the photo on the top of the television, the picture's frames chipped in the lower left corner. Stars, the moon, the scarred cutting board, the way light fell across their bed. What are you aware of right now? What are those more subtle things that are easy to miss? Take about a minute. Notice what you notice, but don't glide right over it. See what you see. Coming back. So I want to open it up before we take a break. One of the things I also really enjoy having as part of our morning is the chance to talk with each other specifically about meditation practice itself. Because it's easy to just, you know, we can have the meditation and then go right into the Dharma talk. But, you know, sometimes there are questions about the practice itself, or something that may have occurred in the meditation that was new for you or not new that you're wondering about. So if anybody has anything about meditation itself, please raise your hand. Let's talk about it. Because when you share about your practice, it's very likely somebody else has actually a similar experience or a similar question, or it might remind somebody else about their question. Anybody at all? Carolyn, please.
This may be a little woo-woo, but it's about showing up. Thursday, I was in meditation. It was the evening with the Zoom group I've been going to since COVID started. And I was just sitting there meditating, and I've been irritable and whatever for a couple of months now in a different way. And I was sitting there in meditation, and I know what visualization is. I know how to lead myself. I know, but this was a download like I've had maybe 10 in 45 years.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, I get, you are so angry. Mm-hmm. Just a baseline of anger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I sat there and two pillars of flame. My eyes were closed. It wasn't my house. Rose beside me. And I just sat there and I realized how I've always felt like I stood on shifting ground. Well, under the shifting ground, there's lava, and I'm angry. And I always did my, I knew I was angry to some extent, but I've always done my practice. I'd go to wherever I was angry and I go, but this is true also, which is a good practice unless you have to be the queen of of denial.
That's great. I love this. This
I'm
is,
fine. And my first teacher, when she said, your childhood was the egg beater and you were the egg. And I said, well, I'm fine. And she'd go, now I know I'm effed. Because she'd have to work with me and did for many years, and I pushed everything away. So what I'm saying is that consistently showing up for meditation at least twice a day since the fall, and at least a few times a week before that, since COVID started. And I just, it's like I didn't try. And I wasn't, when the anger came in, I wasn't delighted. I didn't go into what used to be my manic phase. Oh, now I know. It was just, oh yeah. And it was very somber, sobering. And I spent the next couple of days when I'd feel angry, I would go, oh, I'm angry that my sisters were allowed to bully me when they were much older. And I wouldn't go to, but this is true. I just dropped it and went on. And I carried a little note card around with me. And every time a memory of anger came up, I'd go, oh, I'm angry. So in meditation now, when I start looping on the old anger, I just go, oh, I'm angry.
So what an important practice, a depth of awareness that you're right here with it. And I want to go back to, I don't think this is woo-woo. I think it's what you experience. So we don't need to judge it in any way as something that is, like however we would define that. It's what's true. So interesting. Today we're going to talk about truthfulness and metta as paths of awakening. And so I appreciate that you're bringing this in. And I'm just going to offer one little tweak with that repetitive phrase of, I am angry. What if you took the I am out and actually shifted it to, anger is here? And see what happens, because the truth of any energy, any emotion, is that it's here. When it arises, it is here. And one of the things that we're going to talk about today is that awareness, specific, let's use anger. Awareness of anger isn't angry. Do you get that distinction?
Yes,
Okay, we'll talk more about that.
because I'm not into blame at all. I'm
No,
not.
but those things arise and they are true in the moment,
Yes.
but you are, but that's not, that's just what is flowing through.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else on practice itself? Okay, let's take 5 minutes. Okay. So I spent a couple of months this year taking a deeper dive into the paramis, which I love. And some of you have been with me for all of this, whether you came weekly or you've been coming on Sundays, because I have a Sunday Sangha that meets a couple of times a month. And so I don't always remember what I said where. So bear with me if you've heard this a few times from me, But, this is how the Dharma is. We talk about the same things in varying shapes and iterations all the time. Thank you, Christy. Exactly. And I love that. I love that bit by bit we get exposed to the Dharma, and bit by bit we hear it in different ways depending on the day. Sometimes it's just like that sometimes it just flows over, and sometimes there's a way in which it gets in. And I love coming back to these practices of the paramis. Paramis, defined as the perfections of the heart, these different aspects of the heart that, when developed together, really support the ability to show up again. Things like generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, truthfulness, determination, patience, loving kindness, equanimity. That's the generally accepted list. So today I want to talk about truthfulness and metta, loving kindness, as not only individual paths of awakening, but together paths of awakening. And one of the things that you probably know is that you can pull on any aspect of the Dharma, and it's going to pull ultimately on every other aspect of the Dharma. And that these teachings are so completely intertwined and interdependent that it doesn't really matter where we start. Pema's book, Start Where You Are, because you can't start where you're not. Right? That's the bottom line. You cannot start where you're not. So we start right where we are with what feels resonant. And the other piece of this practice that I love so much is the continual invitation to take what resonates and leave the rest behind. Because in the leaving the rest behind, that doesn't invalidate it. It just says, for right now, that's not landing. And it might land another time. There are all kinds of things in any kind of practice that, just based on how one is, there are things that one is more open to, or it feels right. So that's a long way of saying that I've been really loving coming back to the paramis, and today I want to specifically talk about truthfulness and metta. And when I asked in the very beginning of class, for we did that check-in in the chat, what is true for you right now? How do you locate what's happening in the heart mind? That is a way of meeting truthfulness, just to say, oh, this is what's here right now. And I'm not talking about true and false. I'm just talking about what is present right now, being in relationship with what is present right now. And if we define the word Dharma, it really means nature, the nature of things, how things are. And of course, the Dharma is also defined as what the Buddha taught, the teachings of the Buddha. But I think what the Buddha was teaching was how to be in relationship with the way things are. So that's how I think about it, as a practice and a process of truthfulness. Taking refuge in the Dharma, for me, is relying on the truthfulness of the way things are. So you can play with that, but to think about, really, what does it mean to take refuge, to trust, to rest in, to rely upon anything? And the way things are, the truth of impermanence, the truth of interconnection, the truth of dukkha, the truth that greed and ill will and confused mind lead to suffering, and the truth that aspects of non-greed, right, generosity, all these aspects, non-ill will, kindness, gratitude, compassion, and the clearer mind lead to states of well-being, to states of non-suffering. So that's the Dharma, I think. And then, of course, it's much bigger than that, but that just distills it down to, I think, some brass tacks there. And metta, this practice of loving kindness, can we make our hearts a refuge for all beings? And that includes ourselves. Make my heart a refuge for all beings. Make space for everything, I think, is the practice of metta, then to be able to wish well. And you know this, you know this. So then to begin with two very fundamental ways to begin the practice of exploring truthfulness and metta, let's just use the foundation of mindfulness itself. That mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on, says Thich Nhat Hanh. It is knowing and seeing what's going on. And at face value, that sounds straightforward, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, to know what's going on. But to know what's going on, we have to, I have found, I have to first be in touch with the filters through which I see things. I might think I know what's going on from my perspective, but I don't know what's going on from your perspective. We can each experience the same event and have very different experiences. So this is why we have practices that take us into the specificity of what is the sensation of the inhale, what is the sensation of the exhale. It's not to become an expert breather. It's to become clearer and clearer about what the sensations are of an experience, the literal sensations, how they manifest, and what one's response is to that. And that's how we start distilling down into the essence of mindfulness, presence of mind, knowing what is happening in the mind, heart, and body, pleasant or unpleasant, but with a quality of curiosity and care, right? Willingness. That deep knowing, oh, right now it's like this. So we need that base of mindfulness that we are cultivating all the time. And part of how we do that is through the Buddha's beautiful instruction of ehipassiko. That's the Pali word for come and find out for yourself. Ehipassiko. Ehipassiko. Such a beautiful word that leads us to it. Sometimes it's translated as encouraging investigation. Isn't that great? Encouraging investigation. It's okay to question. It's good to question, to ask why, how does this thing affect me or you, to maybe feel confused or not know what's happening, or just to be in a stuck place and to say to somebody else, what am I not seeing? What are you seeing? What a brave question to say to somebody else, what am I missing? And that other person might feel like they don't know, but maybe there's just another perspective. It's opening perspective. So to approach these practices of truthfulness and metta, we go back to this foundation of mindfulness, that the motivation, the intention to see more clearly all the time, all the time. And this is not to doubt what we already know. This is not to say, I think I've learned it, but now I haven't, but actually to trust your wisdom, to trust what you do know, because you know from your own experience, this very real instruction that the Buddha gave about know it from your direct experience. And here's the beautiful sutta in which he gave that instruction. He said, it is indeed fitting to be uncertain. It is fitting to doubt. For in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide not by what you've heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on the texts, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. When you know for yourself that greed, ill will, and ignorance are unhealthy and inclined towards suffering, you should reject them. And when you know for yourselves that non-greed, non-ill will, non-delusion are healthy and inclined towards welfare and happiness, then you should stay with them. That is the teaching on direct experience, about his directive of don't even believe me. And that whole first part about not relying on text, not relying on reasoning, not because of logic, etc. It's a little bit contradictory, isn't it? So then how am I supposed to know? But I think what he is saying is really trust your direct experience. Try it out. So take the texts, take the view of another person, take your own view and see what happens. Is it accurate? Does it work? And then when you find out, oh, actually this does. When I stay with my body in meditation and I just learn to stay, what happens from that? You know, in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness of the breath and mindfulness of the body, woven into that is the instruction to follow through. Follow through, stay with the inhale and follow it all the way through. Follow the exhale all the way through. So again, this is not to become this expert breather. It's, we apply that to our lives. That's how I interpret that, is the commitment to stay, the commitment to follow through with as much presence as I can bring. And then I find through that, how do I get caught in greed and ill will? Where are those sticky points? What are those things I don't want to know? What are those things I don't want to look at? And I have to temper that with what can I know? What can I look at? It's really hard for me to look at animals that have been hit by cars. Let's just take a really basic everyday thing that is true. I avert my eyes. I avert my eyes to difficult news. Am I keeping myself ignorant or am I protecting my heart? It's a little of both. So this is not asking us to make ourselves completely raw, but to know ourselves more deeply so we can show up with as much skill as possible. Are you with me on this? So this is the value of direct experience. It takes a ton of courage. And the word vipassana, it means clear comprehension of purpose. This ability that we train in seeing more and more clearly. And when we keep showing up and then we have conversations like we're having, what are you noticing in meditation? Or the capacity to say out loud metta prayers, because you're noticing what's happening in your life and around you, and your heart is moved by that, and then we say it out loud. This is part of the direct experience of how these practices come alive, I think. Takes courage to see clearly, vipassana, and then the insights come. So what Carolyn was describing, sitting still over and over and over again, makes space, like an air hole is created, and up comes up that air hole wisdom. Oh, this is what I'm feeling. Oh, and it may come in a visualization. It may come representative, that might come in words, might comes in feelings, but there are these deeper wisdoms, these insights that arise that take us, that is the direct experience that takes us into a deeper understanding of one's own life. And then let's expand that. If I'm feeling that, somebody else surely is feeling that. That's the other piece, is I hope that, I think that when I get this, and maybe this is true for you too, that when I experience something that is, feels big, I know I'm not the only one. And that makes it feel less heavy. It can be big, but it doesn't weigh as much. Because I belong with all of you, and you belong with all of us. And so we're meeting our lives together, and it just makes it easier. Just makes it easier. Rev Angel Kyoto Williams, she says this, "For us to transform as a society, we have to allow ourselves to be transformed as individuals. And for us to be transformed, we have to allow for the incompleteness of any of our truths and a real forgiveness for the complexity of human beings." I want to read that to you again. There's so much in it, and it's valuable. For us to transform as a society, we have to allow ourselves to be transformed as individuals, of course, right? That's like, it's not going to happen on a larger scale unless the component parts also are transformed. And for us to be transformed, we have to allow for the incompleteness of our own truths. We need to see more clearly. We don't already have to know. Can we be incomplete? Right, like that other teaching from the third Zen ancestor, to be without anxiety about non-perfection. All right, this is our incompleteness. This is what we are doing. Somebody else told me recently, when I don't know something, I feel so much shame. And then she went on to say, but then I heard the acronym of shame, which is should have already mastered everything. Should have already mastered everything, for God's sake, right? Can we allow for our not knowing, our incompleteness? Because what if we were complete? Then what? What's left to do? I mean, I want to keep growing and learning and staying curious. So then Rev Angel says, by allowing for our completeness of any of our truths, a real forgiveness for the complexity of human beings arises. Yeah, our deep common humanity. And obviously there are really terrible things that happen that are hard to feel. That practice of forgiveness is really difficult. But that's actually, I don't think, what she's getting to here. That we're talking about a forgiveness of the complexity of who we are. And who, by the way, has the moral or intellectual authority to judge anybody else around complete or incompleteness? Right? Let's just bring that in. Because there's all of that in our conditioning, that there are structures that say this is how one ought to be in their completeness and doesn't allow for everything, the myriadness of what it means. So this is a practice of truthfulness, of being with what is here, of what is now, of what we know. So to take refuge in the Dharma, it is an intention towards truthfulness. The nature of things, meeting what is true now. So let's distinguish between truth and truthfulness. There isn't one truth. And this is critically important. Many things are true at any given time. And you may feel, I may feel, get this expression that says, well, the truth is, to shift to the reality of what I'm experiencing now is, I think is another way of saying the truth is. And I'm just shying away a little bit from that word truth, because I think that there's a lot, it can be very rigid, it can be very othering, it can be, othering, it can really leave a lot out. Much more, I prefer the practice of truthfulness. Truthfulness as a process, as a training, as a quality of being. And many things are true. And this brings us back to mindfulness practice. What is happening now? How does it inform this moment? Whatever is happening now has an impact on my thoughts, on my emotions, on what I say, and what I do. That's all accurate. So we may say, well, there are many things that are true, many things. And then when we can get, we might get stuck in a little bit of this is just the way it is. And this is where we want to bring a little skill to it. To say, oh, it's just like this, and this is how it is. It's never going to change. Well, we know that's not true. True. Isn't, things are going to change. So out of that, to ask this question you've heard me bring in many times, what else is true? What else is happening now? What else is possible? What else is here? And it is a very important distinguishing question, especially when things are difficult. It's a regular question that's used in trauma healing, resiliency development, to be able to get a bigger perspective. What else is true? Not as well, what's really the truth? So I'm just making that distinction again. Here's what Sylvia says in her book, Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. She says, to perfect my truthfulness, I need to be able to tolerate seeing all of who I am and all of what is happening. I need to not feel ashamed or afraid. If I pay attention calmly and steadily, my mind will be unbiased and its secrets will reveal themselves to me in an honest, gentle way. The pleasure I'll experience of not hiding from myself will inspire me to create the intimacy of non-judgmental, gentle honesty with everyone. Isn't that beautiful? So let's take that apart a little bit about how truthfulness cultivates and nurtures the soil of intimacy. Intimacy with myself, intimacy with others. Can I tolerate seeing clearly all of who I am, all of what is happening? Yes and no, right? When our capacity feels bigger, we have more capacity to see things more clearly. When we're startled or frightened, stressed, anxious, maybe anger is present, it makes it more difficult. But our practice, when we come back to what we were talking about earlier, to recognize that the awareness of anger isn't angry, the awareness of joy isn't joyful, the awareness of jealousy isn't jealous, etc. The awareness of generosity isn't generous. It is the awareness we're talking about of whatever is present that takes the I am out of it and gives us more perspective to say, oh, this is what's here. And there's no judgment in that. Maybe there is. I mean, we might definitely have an opinion about, and I don't want this to be here. But what our practice is doing is taking us into this place that builds the space to say, yes, this is here too. I am not my anger. I am not my jealousy. I am not this anger. I am not this jealousy. And you know, even to chronic illness, I remember saying to a friend not long ago who was struggling with brain cancer and she's now much better, you are not your cancer. You are so much more. Yes, this is a really profound thing that is happening. But there's so much more to us than the thing that is happening right now. And that can be hard to keep in perspective, because pain hurts. Loss hurts. That is all true. But that question, what else is true, helps with that perspective. It doesn't dismiss difficulty, but it adds some capacity, a bigger space for it to be met. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, okay. Another teacher, this is a piece that comes from Roshi Pat Ankyo O'Hara's book on intimacy. She said, one teacher was asked, what is the deepest truth? What is the wisdom that liberates? And his response was, I am always close to this. What does that even mean? You know, sometimes these Zen teachings are like, what does it mean, I'm always close to this? It's the closeness itself, the intimacy with what is here, with us now. That is the truth that liberates. Imagine being so close to your experience of life. This is true joy. To be so close to your experience of life, so intimate with your world, that you are filled with awe. You're like a child playing in the grass, staring up at the starry night. The closeness itself is what this is pointing to. That brings us into what is true right now. One of the things that is true right now. Can we be that close, that intimate with our own experience? And I think that's how it brings us into the experience of love, where we come into these different aspects of love to say, ah, when I'm so present with, like this morning, I woke up to bird song. And I love that, you know, to wake up early and the birds are just getting up. And I can make up all kinds of stories about what they're saying to each other. You know, who knows what's going on. But nonetheless, it's all this tinkling of bird song. It's so pleasant. And to take the time to actually just listen to the bird song takes me into an experience of intimacy with their song, with the sound. And noticing that it makes me feel really good. And in that moment brings me into that experience of love. That's really what happens, of awe and reverence take me into experience of love. We also have some deer that live in our yard, pretty much is the best way to describe where I live, in a rural place, and we have a few acres here. And last fall, I'm not exactly sure when it was, this is April, it's probably 6 months ago, 7 months ago, this, all of a sudden, this doe appeared with her two baby fawns, and they were spotted, and teeny tiny little baby fawns. And these two babies would run around the yard doing these zoomies. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. They would zoom around in circles. And the mom would be off to the side, and it felt, and she would just watch them. And it felt to me like she was saying, okay, kids, go play, go play. I'm tired. You go do your thing. But there was so much love in it. And then yesterday I was sitting and having my breakfast, and there they are again. And they hang out a lot, but yesterday in particular, these babies now are way beyond spots, and they're about two-thirds of the size of their mom, but they were doing the same thing. They were running in these amazingly fast circles around the yard. They were, to me, I projected onto them that they were playing catch, they were playing tag, they were playing keep away. And again, the mom was over munching on something, and these babies are just having fun. And I felt, and they're not afraid of us at all. We can go outside and say good morning to them, and they just look at us. And again, it's an intimacy with our experience of being right here. And it fills me with a lot of joy and a lot of love. And I do really love that what is also true is that they are not going to be harmed here. That, like, we cultivate safety. We cultivate well-being, that we can, part of this, a lot of this practice creates intimate space where one can just show up as they are. And I know this is not quite a segue from the deer to that, but it feels like that to me, that I can really love what is here and be very filled by the intimacy of exactly what is here. So with metta, make my heart a refuge for all beings. May all beings, when we say, be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering, may I feel safe and protected. May I feel peace and happiness. May I know good health and strength. May I be at ease. And then we really take those blessings, intentions, prayers, whatever you want to call them, wishes of goodwill for ourselves, and we send them out to others. So take a moment right now, close your eyes. If you take a breath, and what is something kind you could say to yourself right now? One time I asked that question and somebody said, your hair looks great. So, you know, it doesn't have to be some really deep thing. What is something you could say that is kind that you would say to yourself right now? All right, coming back. You know, it's really a sweet thing to do that, to just pause every now and then and say something kind to yourself. So mindfulness and kindness, why we need these heart practices. Mindfulness of knowing what is happening, being able to have that clear presence of mind on its own is not enough. It needs the heart. I mean, we can describe colors, shapes, sounds, sights, taste, what it means to be physically present. But without it being connected to the heart, I experience that as a sterile technique for paying attention, which isn't very interesting to me. I want to know why it matters. And that's where the heart comes in. And over again, you've heard me say, all right, we have all these teachings, but why do they matter? What are the ones that really change you? What are the ones that change me? So mindfulness grows a kind heart when it's in its full fruition. You know how Ram Dass said, love, or awareness plus kindness equals loving awareness. That's what we're doing, right? This kind, wholehearted kindness. And so mindfulness is the ground out of which kindness and compassion can grow. And kindness and compassion need mindfulness. And you've probably heard Sylvia say, every moment of kindness is a moment of mindfulness. Every moment of mindfulness is a moment of kindness. It's true. It is true. They really work well together. The point is to habituate the mind heart towards kindness, because there's plenty of difficulty. So when we come back over and over again to how can I respond in a kind way? Like, for instance, here's an example. Maybe I had sort of in a conversation right now with somebody who we had an agreement that things were going to go a certain way with. I mean, it's nearly not that big of a deal, but what ended up happening is that this other person couldn't deliver on what they thought they would be able to in the way they thought they would be able to. And it had some very real consequences for me. And so we've been in a conversation about how can we work this out. And it has been a really nice conversation about, I'm so sorry this happened, and me saying, yeah, I'm so sorry it happened too. These were the consequences. How can we address it now? And there's been no reactivity. And it is such a pleasure to be able to meet a problem and not make it a problem. Does that make sense? How does a problem not be a problematic? That it has its rough spots, but when two people choose to work together to say, all right, this is not good for either one of us, let's work through it. It's pretty amazing what can happen, because there's a quality of not taking things personally. I don't have to feel any indignation around fairness or unfairness, because first noble truth, garbage happens, right? I mean, it's just the way that is. So then what we're doing continually is dissolving reactivity and going to, how can we meet a difficult thing by not making it more difficult? And you know, it feels really good. I feel like this is the outcome of practice. It doesn't mean that difficulty isn't going to happen. It definitely is. And things that are unfair are going to happen. But it's not about fault, and it's not about blame. It's about, how do we take responsibility in a respectful, kind way that meets what each person needs? And I think that mindfulness and metta has absolutely changed my ability to meet difficulty without the added friction of it should or shouldn't be. It just is. And that is the practice of truthfulness, I think. And metta, you know, I come back over and over again to John Peacock, who's a Pali scholar, a British teacher, who has translated metta as to grow fat with friendliness. To grow fat with friendliness. Isn't that wonderful? Because the word loving kindness is a little bit Victorian, and it doesn't really roll off the tongue in the same way, but friendliness does. Warm-heartedness does. Non-contention is easier. So if I can practice friendliness, turning the thermostat of my heart to warm any chance I get, I'm going to feel better. And if I feel better, those around me are probably going to pick up on that too, and I'm going to pick up on how they feel too. So it starts to become a default setting. So if we come into the first two principles of the Abhidhamma, Buddhist psychology, the first one is to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. The second, compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our deep knowing of our interconnection with everything. So if we start with this inner nobility, we are all fundamentally good. And then because everything is interconnected, there's no other way to be except compassionate, kind. Obviously, there are a lot of other ways to be. I get that. I just, as a turn of a phrase, this just makes so much sense to me, that when we connect our fundamental goodness with the truth of everything is connected to everything else, what arises out of that is kindness. Oh, you too? Oh, you too? That is what happens. That this piece of, we all show up together. And when I said in the meditation that, can you notice the stillness that is right here, right now, inside of you, and let whatever is present for you right now be held in that stillness, and to know that all of us in this room are doing the same thing. It creates such a bigger space for everything to be met, to be held. I don't think that's a figment of my imagination. I think this is what happens. I think I want to end with a story that exemplifies this, and then we'll have time to talk with each other. This is one of my favorite books. It's called One Long River of Song by Brian Doyle, who was a brilliant writer who's no longer in his body, but he's left us a very big body of gorgeous work. And this is a book of essays. And I want to read this story to you. It's called The Hawk. Recently, a man took up residence on my town's football field, sleeping in a small tent in the northwestern corner near the copse of cedars. He had been a terrific football player some years ago for our high school, and then had played in college, and then a couple of years in the nether reaches of the professional ranks, where a man might get paid $100 a game plus bonuses for touchdowns and sacks. Then he'd entered into several business ventures, but these had not gone so well, and he had married and had children, but that hadn't gone well either. And finally, he'd taken up residence on the football field because, he said, that was where things had gone well, and he sort of needed to get balanced again, and there was something about that field that was working for him as far as he could tell. So with all due respect to people who thought he was a nutcase, he decided he would stay there until someone made him leave. He'd already spoken with the cops, and it was a mark of general decency of our town that he was told he could stay as long as he didn't interfere with the use of the field, which, of course, he would never think of doing, and it was summer anyway, so the field wasn't in much use. He'd been nicknamed the Hawk when he was a player for his habit of lurking around almost lazily on defense and then making a stunning strike. And he still speaks the way he played, quietly, but then amazingly. When we sat on the visiting team's bench the other day, he said some quietly amazing things, which I think you should hear. The reporter from the paper came by, he said. She wanted to write a story about the failure of the American dream and the collapse of the social contract, and she was just melting to use football as a metaphor or something or other. And I know she was just trying to do her job, but I kept telling her things that didn't fit what she wanted, like that people come by and leave me cookies and sandwiches, and the kids who play lacrosse at night set up a screen so my tent won't get peppered with stray shots, and the cops drift by at night to make sure no one's giving me grief. Everyone gets nailed at some point, so we understand someone getting nailed and trying to get back up on his feet again. I'm not a drunk, and there's no politicians to blame. I just lost my balance. People are good to me. You try to get lined up again. I keep the field clean. Mostly it's discarded water bottles, lost cell phones I hang in a plastic bag by the gate. I walk the perimeter a lot. I saw some coyote pups the other day. I don't have anything smart to say. I don't know what things mean. Things just are what they are. I never sat on the visitor's bench before, did you? Someone leaves coffee for me every morning by the gate. The other day, a lady came by with twin infants, and she let me hold one while we talked about the football. That baby weighed about half of nothing. You couldn't believe a human being could be so tiny, and there were two of him. That reporter, she kept asking me what I'd learned and what I would say to her readers if there was only one thing I could say. And I told her, what could possibly be better than standing on a football field holding a brand new human being the size of a coffee cup? You know what I mean? Everything else is sort of a footnote. Isn't that gorgeous? The truthfulness of our experience, of being here, of connecting, of knowing we belong to each other, of what it means to show up. It's such a pleasure to be here. And next week, Sylvia will be here, and then I will be here the first two Wednesdays of May. And I just want to give you an open invitation here. Because we're going to have 2 weeks together, if there are some topics that are on your mind that you would like to take a look at and that maybe I can bring in some perspective on, send me an email saying I'm interested in whatever. And here's my email address. It's Heidi@pacificmindfulness.com. It's totally public. Heidi@pacificmindfulness.com. If you've got something you want me to talk about, I'd love to know what's on your mind. Okay? So we offer up the goodness of everything that happened today from our showing up. May it support us. May it support each other. May it go out in the world to somehow decrease the suffering that is everywhere. Thank you, everybody.